Today on Maine Calling, immigrants and legal status. What does it mean to be here legally? That question is at the heart of the controversy over immigration and enforcement agency arrests here in Maine and in other states. And the answer depends on the person. Different immigrants hold different immigration statuses, and many are in limbo, waiting for court hearings. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn about the experience of immigrants here in Maine and which of those appear to be targeted by ICE agents. What does it mean to be a lawful permanent resident, an asylum seeker, or to have a temporary visa? Do rights depend on immigration status? And how does the process of authorization work? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. Quarry Cottages at Highland Green, committed to providing low-maintenance living and offering custom homes in Quarry Cottages, highlandgreenlifestyle.com. And by Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. As we continue to cover the increase in immigration enforcement in Maine, we turn to the topic of immigration law. We're going to learn about the distinctions between different types of legal status for immigrants, and we'll talk about legal rights for immigrants, including when encountering ICE agents. Joining me for the hour, Anna Welch, who is a professor of law at the University of Maine School of Law and founding director of the Refugee and Human Rights Clinic. Sarah Cressy is staff attorney at UMaine's UMaine Law's Refugee and Human Rights Clinic and a visiting professor of law. And James Wagner is an immigration attorney practicing in Maine and Massachusetts. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you have questions about any of this? Maybe the difference between asylum seekers or green card holders or people with temporary visas, or about the basic rights of immigrants? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. Again, talk@mainepublic.org. If you send an email, please keep it brief. You can post on comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for joining us today. And Anna, I'm going to start with you. I think the big question that so many people are asking is, who is here legally? It's a term that I know can be very vague, and I'm sure you're asked this question all the time. How do you think about this question of who is here in Maine in the U.S. legally?
I think that's a great question, and there's a lot of misinformation out there on this question. And I think first, I just want to clarify that the term legal or illegal are not defined, nor are they part of our underlying U.S. statutes or regulations. These are terms that are used by the media or by members of our public, but are not actually accurate under our U.S. laws. And I think the most important one is illegal alien. That's a term that's used frequently, but is in fact inaccurate under our laws, because to be here without authorization, and I can describe what that is not a crime. And certainly the terms illegal alien can be quite dehumanizing to the people who are called that. So we typically use the terms, you know, citizen, or they're a non-citizen, or documented or undocumented. But certainly to your question, because I know there's a lot of confusion, and these terms are used frequently nowadays. But undocumented simply means that a person does not have lawful immigration status in the United States. Maybe they actually entered with lawful status, right, on a valid visa, but that visa has expired and they have not pursued some other lawful status, or they entered into the country without permission. So entered outside of one of our ports of entry without permission. There are, many people in Maine who are being labeled undocumented or illegal who are in fact legally here. And in particular, I'll hone in on asylum seekers, for example, those on temporary protected status, those who are unaccompanied minors who are on what's called special immigrant juvenile status, those with deferred action, right? The government is not pursuing them for removal proceedings. They have a legal right to be here. So particularly asylum seekers, they are in this sort of limbo status, but under US and international law, we as a country cannot. It's illegal for us to deport them without their opportunity to have their day in court to explain to the judge and defend why they should not be removed based on the fact that they fear persecution or even death in their home country. So while their cases are pending, many are eligible for work permits. Those are work permits that are granted by the Department of Homeland Security. So again, I think those folks are not illegal. They're not undocumented. They're legally here. They're just in this process. And that process, and we can talk more about this today, can take multiple years, but they certainly are allowed to be here. And in fact, we have to allow them to be here.
Yeah. And Sarah, I'll have you follow up on what Anna says is when you say these people are not undocumented, they are documented. What kind of documents they hold? And actually, I'm going to broaden the question a little bit because I know that you're working one-on-one with people who are in this state. Would you say that most of the people in Maine who are recent immigrants fall into this category of asylum seekers or not really? I mean, I feel like much of our conversation is about people who have come here, they're seeking asylum, yet they have not had their day in court yet. Is that really most of the people that we're talking about here today?
So in terms of folks who are here in our communities in Maine, it's hard to say. I mean, there's a really broad range of sort of what types of documentation folks have, how they entered the country. And we don't really have a sort of like centralized, reliable way of tracking, for example, like how many asylum seekers are living in Maine versus how many folks with TPS. Although I think we have more accurate numbers as to TPS. But to answer your question, we do have a large population of folks in Maine who are asylum seekers. So they have filed an asylum application with either the Immigration Court or U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, one of our other federal agencies. And they have work permits and they're just waiting for their hearing. We have folks who have been granted asylum, which means they are asylees. That is a status, right? Someone who has been granted asylum. We have green card holders. We have folks who have been granted temporary protected status. You know, we have folks here on temporary worker visas. I mean, there really is such a broad range of statuses and folks in terms of types of documentation and permission that folks have to be here living and working.
Okay. And Sarah, I want you to explain what temporary protected status means. That may be one of the first terms that we need to get a little definition of.
Sure. So temporary protected status is a form of, as the name suggests, temporary protection, temporary permission to live and work in the United States. It is sort of designated and granted by the executive branch and offers protection to folks whose their home countries are experiencing some type of instability, whether it be civil war or unrest, climate-related disaster. And so the executive branch can say, okay, we are recognizing TPS for, Ukraine, Somalia, the population of a country. The folks who are from that, citizens of that country can then apply to the federal government and say, you know, I need temporary protection for removal under this program because of, you know, this issue that's been identified by the U.S. government.
Yeah, go ahead, James.
Yeah, just on those two terms that you used, Jennifer, recent immigrants and day in court, I'd say a lot of people that I know that I represent are not recent immigrants. They're people that are waiting for their interview with the USCIS, which is not court. That can be the first step in a process before you're sent to court and where you can get asylee status. Right now we're adjudicating, or I shouldn't say adjudicating, but we're having interviews with the USCIS in Boston for people that applied for asylum in 2015 and 2016. So over a decade ago, and they have not had their first interview. And if they
I'm going
get
to stop you because I want to make sure we're really clear about this. There are people who have come to this country in 2015, and not only are they not waiting to see an immigration judge, they are waiting to have their sort of original interview, the interview in which they the authorities get to know who they are and what their reasons for being
Right.
here are. They've waited more than 10 years for that first interview.
Oh, I have dozens and dozens of clients in that posture. People that applied in 2014, 2015, 2016, who have not yet had their first interview.
And that is the norm. That is the norm. And
And
are
they have
those
work
people, and these are
authorization.
people who have work authorization. So
That's
these are,
correct.
if someone has this idea that there are people who have entered this country in the middle of the night and are living lives that are in hiding, that is completely inaccurate, right, James?
That's certainly not the norm in the state of Maine. Most people that are in the state of Maine, at least from my client base, most people arrived here with a U.S. visa. There are some people that did not, that came through the southern border, but many, many people waiting for to have their cases heard in Maine are people who arrived with a U.S. visa and then applied for asylum with the USCIS.
Well,
If I
yeah, go ahead, Anna.
can add, I think it's the norm in the state of Maine, but it's also the norm nationally. We have projects at the border where folks, had been waiting pursuant to remain in Mexico or pursuant to the CBP-1 program, which is a program that's now no longer in existence, but under former President Biden, where folks had to sort of get in line and to even get through the border. And so there's thousands of people who have followed these channels that the US government has set up for them to come in, who are fleeing persecution from their home countries, arriving into the United States and as quickly as they can, applying for asylum and getting on the same track that Jamie has identified, right? Applying for their work permits and following through with the procedural requirements of their asylum applications.
And are these the people who are being arrested, Sarah? Are these the people that this is not a legal term, but I think most of us would describe as in limbo. Are these who the very people who are being targeted?
Yes, absolutely right. I was just going to jump in and say, I think to Anna's point, we've heard a lot of rhetoric out of the current presidential administration referring to asylum seekers as illegal aliens, which is just incredibly misleading and inaccurate, right? These are folks who have permission to be here, who have been granted work authorization. And, under prior administrations, the Department of Homeland Security had enforcement priorities that it set, right? Recognizing that it is literally impossible for us to detain and remove every single person who is an immigrant or even everyone who is undocumented in the US. So prior administrations would say, okay, we are really only going to go after folks who have violent criminal convictions or things like that. So in the past, I would not have been worried that a client of mine who was, an asylum seeker with a work permit who's just living here and working, I would have virtually no concern that they would be detained unless they had some sort of new criminal conviction that was happening. Now we are advising all of our clients about their rights to the extent they interact with ICE because those priorities no longer exist. And so folks who are simply asylum seekers here with a work permit, no criminal history, are being arrested. And I think a large proportion of the folks we've seen who have been picked up here in Maine fall within that category.
Well, we're going to turn now to Mafalo Chittum, who is Executive Director of the Maine Immigrant Rights Coalition. Thanks so much for calling in, Mufalo.
Thank you for having me.
Mufalo, I was wondering if you could give us a sense of the makeup of Maine's immigrant population, wondering who some of the larger groups are here in Maine and where they're from.
Yeah, I think when you think of I would say from 2015 to maybe to date, prior to that, Maine is a refugee resettlement state. Prior to that, we had, and we still have one of the largest communities who've come in under the refugee status. And then they become, citizens from there. Most of our, voting community is that population. you know, we have the Somalis as well, and we have the Sudanese as well. And then we had, you know, the Asian community that has been here as well longer. So you see that, you know, that population. But from 2015, especially from 2019, we had an increased number of people come to Maine who are, you know, seeking asylum. Some have been asylum granted and ended up being, you know, citizens. But there's a lot more people who are in what they, I think what you were calling, you know, people who are in limbo, as in they've, their asylum is, you know, pending, and, you know, they're following the law and they have their work permits and they're working. And so that number as well, I would say, I don't know, because the census 2010 and 2020, we had a jump from like about 54,000, you know, it's not just immigrants, but just, you know, people of color, to almost just under maybe about 84 something. So you're talking about a big jump of almost 20,000 people, and the census is not accurate. So you would say the bulk of that is people who have come in, you know, and are, you know, in line to waiting for their asylum, you know, to be processed. And so that's what you find now. It is, maybe I would say, when we look at the numbers, there would be, you know, right around, you know, the people who came in as refugees and they are citizens, and then, or they are on TPS, you know, those numbers with those, you know, kind of like, I would say, you know, thirds, you know, a third of each.
When you say a third of each, a third of the people here in Maine came as refugees, a third have come as asylum seekers, and a third something else?
Yes, I would say actually a third, as because we still have continued getting people coming in resettled as refugees, but the numbers have reduced, you know, from administration to administration. But when you think of, you know, from 2010 to 2020, you know, that number jumped. But we had, you know, in 2019, we had a lot of people come to Maine through, you know, when we had the first expo, and then COVID, we had also, you know, a huge number of people come, and then post-COVID. And so those numbers, and that's where you see, you know, like people who are working in healthcare. When last week started, when the surge started, within 3 days, you know, we had a statement from Maine Health, you know, regarding concern of people not being able to go to work. And so you can see from that picture to say, you know, these are people who feel at risk. You know, the majority of them who have their work permits, they've been waiting for the asylum, but are feeling like they're saying, it's a mix now. You can't tell, you know, you are safe, you are not, you know, it's just like you do not have a status according to this administration when you do have, when you have your asylum pending.
And Mufalo Chinamat, I should let you know that tomorrow on Maine Calling, we're going to focus on the experience, the impact on the community of this surge. And of course, talking to hospitals is part of that, and healthcare facilities and nursing homes is part of that program. But Mufalo, the numbers that we're hearing from ICE are not that new. We're hearing 200 arrests. Is that what you understand as well, or is there a larger number?
Well, that's what we are hearing, but our hotline has been tracking, you know, people who are calling, asking for detention support, you know, referrals to, you know, to ILAP or to lawyers or seeking that support. And I mean, our numbers in terms of tracking that are right around, you know, the high 70s. So the 200, again, not everybody is seeking support through us, but we're not yet able to verify that 200. But, you know, but we're also just looking at the people who are asking for referral for support. So So I guess, we'll figure out very soon, those numbers when they, if they do show up on the, locator, the detainee locator.
All right, Emufalo, before you go, I'll have you give out that hotline number. I know we did the other day. Go ahead.
Oh, my goodness, do I even know it now? Our number is 207-544-9989. Again, 207-544-9989. Thank you so much.
Mufalo Chittum, thank you so much for calling in. I know you're incredibly busy. She's executive director of the Maine Immigrant Rights Coalition. Last time this number was given out, somebody on Facebook, Rick, asked, what's ICE's 800 number? You should be representing both sides of the conversation. So in response to Rick, I will say that the ICE tip line is 866-DHS-2ICE, 866-DHS-2ICE. To ICE. We're talking about immigration law on Maine Calling today. What are your questions for our experts? You can call 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The types of legal status for immigrants can be confusing. So we're learning about them today on Maine Calling and learning a little about the process for immigrants to become lawful residents. With me today, Jamie Wagner, an attorney focused on immigration, and Anna Welch and Sarah Cressy. They are both with UMaine Law's Refugee and Human Rights Clinic. Anna Welch is founder of the clinic and Sarah Cressy is staff attorney. We invite you to join the conversation. Send us your questions, a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org, or phone number 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us right now, Chrissy Fernandez, who is managing attorney at Landis, Arne, and Janes in Westbrook. Thanks so much for calling in, Chrissy.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you for having me. I did want to clarify, I'm an associate attorney.
Okay. I understand you have clients who were recently detained. Can you describe their situation? What was their status? And how was it that ICE agents arrested and detained them?
So we have been, receiving reports of clients being detained for interactions with law enforcement. So, disturbances in the home, something that leads to law enforcement investigating, incidents. And that has then caused ICE to become aware of the individuals, many of whom have pending applications for relief, such as asylum or other types of applications. And then once, ICE hears about the incident and, hears about the investigation, they have gone and detained clients. So that's one of the types of examples we've recently experienced.
You also have clients who, I understand, encountered ICE agents in Maine but were released. Tell us how that happened. What is the difference between the clients that have been taken into custody and those who've been released?
We've had instances where individuals are driving a vehicle that is registered to someone who may have an application pending. And in that instance, family members that have been driving a vehicle registered to a person that is, seeking an immigration benefit, those family members have been stopped. And, once the identification has been made that it's actually not the person applying for the immigration benefit that's driving the vehicle, they have then been released, which indicates that ICE is obviously looking at license plates, running information to see whether the driver of a vehicle and the owner of that vehicle is someone that they're looking for.
All right. I understand, Chrissy, that you have some tips you're providing your clients on how to reduce contact with ICE and what documents to carry with you.
Yes, definitely. So we are, telling our clients to please carry their receipts with them. So if they have a pending asylum case, if they have a pending family-based you know, immigration case where they're waiting for a green card through marriage, to carry those documents with them so that they can show if they are, you know, stopped by ICE or detained that they're waiting for some kind of application to be approved. Also, we're telling them to memorize phone numbers, friends or family members. That way, if they are detained, they're able to reach out. Because one of the problems that we're seeing is that, you know, individuals don't memorize phone numbers anymore. We all have numbers in our cell phones, but once ICE detains someone, they remove the cell phone from the person. So it's good to have phone numbers memorized. Also, avoiding any unnecessary travel, which is sad to say, but that's the state of affairs right now. Avoid committing any kind of traffic infractions. If you have a benefit pending, to make sure that you don't give the police or ICE a reason to stop the vehicle. Avoiding frequenting places where there's a large number of immigrants. Again, sad that we have to give this advice, but ICE is looking for immigrants in this country, and if there is a place where there's a large number of individuals congregating, it's likely that ICE may target those areas. So keeping a low profile at this time right now is important.
Chrissy, thank you so much for calling in. Chrissy Fernandez, an associate attorney in Westbrook, specializing in immigration law. Associate attorney with Landis, Arne, and James in Westbrook. James, you've also had clients who have been detained, I understand. Give us an example.
Yeah, I've had many, and I think we should have this in the context of these are individuals that have come from countries where they fled because of armed, masked men abducting them on the streets, taking them away from their homes and their families with no notice to their families and without the right to contact their counsel. That is literally now happening in our state of Maine. So to give you an example, I have a client detained. He was picked up after the ICE officers ran his vehicle plate, found out his name, found out he was an immigrant, so they stopped him. This individual is already in removal proceedings. That means he was already in immigration court. He had had his asylum application. Cases get referred, they call it, referred to immigration court, so that's passed on for an additional evidentiary hearing. He was already in that process. So they detained him because they have arrest quotas. That didn't change his procedural posture. He was already docketed in court. He already had a hearing date. So the only thing that changed was that they traumatized an individual. They handcuffed him, they jailed him, and they deprived him of his liberty. Then they processed him in Scarborough ICE. They detained him at the Cumberland County Jail. Then they moved him to the Plymouth Correctional Facility in Massachusetts. I entered my appearance as an attorney. They did not communicate with me. They did not notify me. And then they removed him from Massachusetts, flew him at taxpayer expense to Louisiana, detained him there. Then again, without notifying his attorney, flew him to Arizona and detained him there. They're just hiding the immigrant from their attorney. And this is outrageous. It's against our due process rights, but this is what is happening.
James, what can you do now in this situation?
So I made a request for what's called a custody redetermination hearing, also known as a bond hearing. And I will have, for that individual, luckily, I will have a hearing tomorrow afternoon. And I will present evidence that this person is not a threat or a danger to the community and that he's not a flight risk, which he's neither of those things. And it's the burden of the U.S. government to show that he's one of those things, which they will not be able to do.
So if this hearing happens tomorrow and you prevail, does that mean that your client will be flown back from Arizona to Maine?
That's a very good question, Jennifer. I don't actually have the answer to that, but if we prevail, he will be provided the ability to post a bond. And those bonds typically are somewhere between $1,500 on the low end, which is unusual, to as high as $20,000. And if his family or friends is able to post a bond, which must be posted by a U.S. citizen or a legal permanent resident, then he would be released. Whether or not they'll fly him back, I don't know. You've heard a lot of stories about people being abandoned at borders, and just having to fend for themselves.
And Sarah, I see you shaking your head. If you had cases already where someone has been has prevailed and is supposed to be on their way back to Maine, but has not been able to come back?
So we haven't had any clients released from facilities as far away as Louisiana or Arizona, but we understand, you know, Anna and I work closely with partners at other law schools and nonprofits across the country on these issues. And our understanding is that folks are literally just, actually, in the example of the Romesa Ozturk, the tough student who was detained, she was released from the detention center in Louisiana, right? They're not going to sort of fly her back anywhere. They just sort of release the person from wherever they are. And certainly that's been the case for clients of ours who have been released from detention facilities elsewhere in New England, right? They're not provided transportation back to Maine. They are sort of released from the facility. Often folks are released, you know, with like the clothes they come in with. It's freezing cold. They may not have a jacket. They may not have the ability to contact folks. And they're literally just released onto the street wherever they are when they're, if to the extent, as Jamie said, they're able to post bond.
We're joined now. Yeah, go ahead, James. Jamie. Yeah,
and keep in mind that I have, in the last 3 months, 8 detained clients, 6 of whom had never been charged with a single crime, 7 of whom had never been convicted of a crime. One of them had been convicted of OUI, right? So that's a crime, and I'm not diminishing that that's a crime. And many people that are convicted of OUI do not get bond. So we're talking about people that have never been charged with a crime or committed a crime who just get picked up to fulfill arrest quotas. They're here illegally. They're working. They're with their family. They have U.S. citizen children. They're getting detained for no reason at tremendous taxpayer expense and trauma.
Joining us now is Jenny Beverly, who is an immigration law attorney with Haven Immigration Law in Portland. She has also served as an immigration judge. Jenny, thanks for calling in.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
How does the process work for when someone goes before an immigration judge?
That's a big question. And so when we are at the court and the respondent appears, there's a variety of different applications that they would have filed or are prepared to file. And so it is the judge's job at that time to essentially analyze the merits of each of the petitions. Majority of the cases that I saw were referred or entered at the border and entered directly into the immigration court for asylum proceedings.
Do most people, and actually I'm going to narrow this down because I know there's so many different statuses. We're talking about people who are applying for asylum. Do most people who eventually get to see an immigration law, most people from Maine, receive that asylum status?
That is a statistics question that I really couldn't answer. Mm-hmm. The Chelmsford Immigration Court, where I served, had Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, and Rhode Island as the cases that would appear in front of us. And so I couldn't tell you specifically the stats for Maine. I can tell you that it's a very subjective process, and the part of the judge's job is to determine things like credibility or likelihood of well-founded fear of future persecution. And so the grant rate for different cases vary by judge.
Varies by judge. I was going to ask how much latitude there is, but there's already, you've answered that question. I imagine, Jenny, it's very difficult sometimes if people have left a state, that a place that is in turmoil, maybe even considered a failed or collapsed state. And as Jamie said earlier, he has clients that have he's been working with for 10 or 11 years. It must be very difficult for clients to sometimes prove their case.
Absolutely. It's one of the more difficult things for a lot of clients. I have represented immigrants personally before I became a judge, and I'm representing them now. And proof and evidence is one of the things that we're always looking for, and we're always giving lists out to our clients. And the fact is, though, that many, many people enter the United States and are unable to get the documents from their home country to prove what happened to them. We have to view their credibility, how they tell their story, as part of the analysis on granting or denying a case. But of course, we're always also looking for objective evidence. So if someone's been physically harmed and they went to a hospital, you know, we would definitely encourage that they go get the evidence of treatment at a hospital. Even if they have scars that have healed over time, but the scars remain, we could even ask that there be evidence in the United States of someone looking at that scar and, you know, opining on whether or not it's consistent with what happened to them in their home country. And so absolutely, it's a very expensive process for a lot of the immigrants, but it's also very difficult as well when everybody has even scattered. You know, if you're talking to neighbors about, you know, do you remember when the police came to my house and broke down my door, and the neighbor themselves have scattered, it's very, very difficult to find them and very difficult to get this evidence. And that's something that is absolutely taken into consideration at the court.
Jenny, before we say goodbye, I just was wondering if there's anything else that you feel, especially as somebody who used to be an immigration judge, that the members of the public don't understand about the system that's important to understand.
This is actually very similar to what Anna and Sarah have said, which is that many of these people have come to apply for asylum and to ask for assistance from the United States because they were fearing danger and harm and persecution. And so they have done what they were required to do. They entered the United States, they filed the application, either they waited for CBP-1 at the border or they did cross and immediately brought themselves to the attention of Border Patrol. They're not here illegally, and they are and have the right to apply for asylum. So the sheer terror that is currently happening for a lot of these very traumatized already clients and immigrants is, at the end of the day, a violation of their constitutional rights and it's just inhumane.
Jenny, thank you so much for calling. That was Jenny Beverly, who is a former immigration judge and now practices immigration law in Portland. We're going to take another quick break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we're talking about immigration law. Joining me, Sarah Cressy with UMaine Law's Refugee and Human Rights Clinic, Anna Welch, the founder of UMaine's Refugee and Human Rights Clinic, and Jamie Wagner, an immigration attorney. Share your comments and questions. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to go to an email here from Tom. Tom writes, I'm a bit confused on the description provided regarding a person's legal status. If a person enters the country outside of a legal point of entry, hasn't that person committed a misdemeanor offense? And if so, isn't that considered to be a crime? While I don't think any such person should be arrested, I did think the definition provided was confusing. And I think this is a big question for a lot of people. Anna, I'll turn to you. Isn't the act of crossing the border without permission a crime?
So it gets complicated. So the act of re-entering after a formal order of removal is a crime. I believe, depending on the state, I think it's a felony crime in Texas. But I can let my colleagues here on the call speak to that. But the act of entering the country illegally is a civil violation to be here without authorization. It's like jaywalking, it's like speeding, it's a civil offense. It is not a crime. And I think that's the rhetoric I'm trying to clarify. And I don't know if my colleagues on the call would like to add anything to that as well.
Same as my understanding.
Okay. And I'll go to this question here from Michael on Facebook. It's amazing that some people are here legally and have had cases pending since 2014 or 2015. There was a proposed border bill in 2024 to help deal with immigration issues that did not pass the Senate. Would that have helped these cases go through more quickly or change how asylum claims are adjudicated? Do any of you know? Can you speak to that, Sarah?
So I guess what I'll say about this is I can't remember the exact details of that particular bill. There have been various efforts to tackle parts of our immigration system over the years, but there hasn't been sort of a major overhaul of our immigration since 1996. So if we're talking about, you know, looking at the immigration system as a whole and thinking about how we can improve it, that really hasn't been on the table for 3 decades. And so, yes, there have been sort of efforts in some recent bills that have been before Congress to tackle parts of, you know, what I think folks see as and what are major issues with our immigration system. But at this point, our immigration system is just so backlogged. So there are a lot of really serious challenges with the system that I think would require a more comprehensive overhaul.
Jamie.
Yeah, if the Trump administration was interested in speeding up processing, they've done exactly the opposite of what they should do. They have literally shut down the adjudication of all asylum claims at the USCIS. So when I go to asylum interviews in Boston now, they will do the interview and then they will say, we'll let you know what the result is someday later by mail. But the asylum officers know they're not allowed to. They're not allowed to do a final adjudication because Trump said they can't. So it is shut down right now. Now, with immigration court, what has Trump done? He's fired a tremendous amount of immigration judges. So he's impeding the process of all these claims. It is entirely his fault, his administration's fault, that the system is going slower than it ever has.
The Trump administration has fired over 100 immigration judges since last January, and that has significantly increased the processing time in immigration courts that are already so underwater.
Yeah, I think the latest statistic, and this is, I think, from September of last year, so September 2025, is there are nearly 3.5 million cases pending in immigration courts around the country, and close to 2.3 million of those are folks who have been seeking or who are seeking asylum. And that does not include what Jamie had mentioned earlier, those who are applying before U.S. citizenship and immigration services. So we've got a 2.3 million person backlog for asylum cases. And so the firing of judges, the institution of the policy that asylum offices cannot render decisions in these cases is only going to further that backlog. And what we've seen is a pouring in of money. And this is not just under this administration, although we're seeing it in much larger numbers under this administration, but certainly under Biden and Obama, a pouring of money into border enforcement and other things, but not sort of addressing the real wound in the system, which is needing comprehensive immigration reform, because as Sarah said, we haven't seen that since 1996, and beefing up the systems to actually process folks, because how inhumane to have them be here 12, 15, however many years, have U.S. citizen children become part of our, you know, neighbors in our communities, and just to say, oops, you don't qualify for asylum, we believe you, but you're not eligible because of XYZ difficult, you know, and our caller, Jenny Beverly, who was an immigration judge, speaking to the complexities of asylum cases, oops, you actually aren't eligible, so we're going to remove you, despite all of these ties that you've gained in our community.
Anna, we have had a couple of people call in who are upset that I gave out the ICE tip line number. And I want to frame the question to you by asking, does ICE have any legitimate role here in Maine?
Yeah, I think that's a complicated question. I think certainly I think the approach that ICE is taking in Maine, just as the approach that they have been taking nationally, is incredibly problematic. Just under our Constitution, due process, equal protection, sort of the racist approaches that we're seeing play out is incredibly problematic. Should ICE have a role in terms of enforcing our immigration laws? I mean, I think that they do. It's under our system. That is ICE's job, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They are although they are civil police officers, right, they are charged with enforcing our immigration laws. But the approach and how they do that, I think, is what is what we are seeing play out on the national stage and certainly on the regional stage is highly problematic. And I hope one that this administration is looking at and relooking at carefully in light of the different human rights abuses and murders and other things we've seen play out.
And I'll just add to what Anna was saying by commenting on the sort of, and I think Anna touched on this a little bit, the sort of the amount of resources that are currently being diverted into immigration enforcement. So I saw, I can't take credit, this is something I saw online, right? This is, someone said, this is the equivalent of like police going after everyone who has ever jaywalked before, right? We're talking about a civil offense. It being in the United States without lawful status is a civil offense. And so, right, if you think about the amount of resources, and Jamie was touching on this as well, the taxpayer dollars that are being diverted to arresting folks, detaining folks, housing folks in detention, flying people in between detention centers, it's just a massive amount of resources that are being devoted to this. And there are a lot of other things that those resources could be sort of re-diverted to. So I think that's also a point worth highlighting.
Email here from Lee. Please go over again the specific steps of seeking asylum. The descriptions so far are not clear enough for someone who believes everyone who is entering seeking asylum is a criminal to know what is really going on. So, Jamie, I'll put you on the spot. How can you clearly explain what the steps are of seeking asylum?
So depending on how you enter the United States, you either have the right to apply for asylum on an application form, it's called an I-589, that you would file with the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, or if you were detained at the border or something like that, you would be put into removal proceedings, so you'd be filing with the court instead of the Immigration Services. So you fill out a form, you explain the fear that you have of return to your country. You should provide corroborating evidence, which would include your own affidavit or declaration, supporting witnesses, evidence of any harm that you suffered, any summonses that you were shows that you were pursued by the police or the authorities in your home country. You get corroborating witnesses from around the world, wherever you're from, that can that they know something about your case. It's complex. You're doing a very substantial evidentiary submission to either the Immigration Services or the Immigration Court. And then you're allowed to be heard by either the interviewing officer at the asylum office or by an immigration judge, and you prove your case.
All right. And let me ask you, you said it depends on how they came here. Once you finally do get before that judge, Jamie, in your experience, does it matter how you entered the country? Do people who overstayed their visa, for example, are they considered differently than people who, say, walked across the border in Texas?
Yeah, there is a difference in process, but substantively, it's the same. You still have to prove that you fear either you suffered past persecution based on a protected ground, or that you have a well-founded fear of future persecution based on a protected ground. And when I say a protected ground, there's five protected grounds. That's race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or a particular social group, which is a very amorphous category.
All right, we'll try to squeeze in a question here. Go to Emily in Rockport. Hi, Emily, go ahead.
Hi, quick question for you. I know nobody has a crystal ball, but I'm just wondering, with the momentum gaining on both sides of the coin, what do you predict we are going to be seeing in the next 2 weeks, 2 months, 12 months?
Okay, Emily, thank you. Do any of you have a sense of where we are and what's coming next?
I think it is very difficult to predict what is coming. What we know based on what has happened so far is that with the passage of the Big Beautiful Bill last summer, billions of dollars have been given to ICE and allocated for immigration enforcement. So that money is there, it has been given to them. And so that means that absent some sort of change, I think we will continue to see the kinds of increased enforcement that we've been seeing so far. I don't know if Anna and Jamie have any ideas.
I think that's right. And within that bill, I think over $11 billion it might be million. No, I think it's billion. We're poured into immigration detention. And so I think we're going to see the construction of even more of the private immigration facilities, that the really jail-like prisons that are all along our border. But I think we'll see many more of those facilities springing up around the country, and more folks being subjected to that dragnet of immigration detention.
Yeah, and keep in mind that the only people that are really benefiting from the current state of affairs are those private prison facilities that are corporations, that are profit-seeking corporations, that are benefiting from the detention of lawfully present people in the United States who have not committed any crimes. It's common for my clients to be detained for 4 weeks with no criminal charge or conviction.
Mm. Well,
it's $200 a day to detain those people.
We're out of time. The voices you just heard, Jamie Wagner, immigration attorney based in Maine and Massachusetts, Anna Welch, professor of law at UMaine Law and founding director of the Refugee and Human Rights Clinic, and Sarah Cressy, also with the Refugee Clinic, a visiting professor of law at UMaine Law. Today's sound engineer, Sam Tracy. Maine Calling's produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow, we're going to look at the impact on communities. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.